This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and you can find them anywhere in this country. I think our last program, we heard from a gentleman who spent most of his life in the Florida Keys, and now we're on the exact opposite end of the lower 48, about as southwestern as you can get in California, Coronado Island, which has been the lifelong home of 93-year-old Tom Rice, a World War II paratrooper, and a guy who still likes jumping out of airplanes. But let's go way, way back. You're born in August of 1921, growing up out here in San Diego, in Coronado. What was it like in Coronado in the 1920s and 30s?
The city in which naval aviation was born.
Mm-hmm.
This was a city that will take care of you and look after you. For the most part, we were coddled here in the Coronado. We were protected.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned military courtesies in a big hurry in this city.
And you probably saw a lot of planes flying around.
Oh, sure. Yeah, North Island is attached to Coronado, and so they were coming in and going out all the time.
You were a distance runner for the Islanders of Coronado High way back when?
Yeah, I ran the, as a B-class runner, a young kid, I ran the 1320, which was a three-quarter mile. I did pretty well in that, and I earned my way to the state meet in Los Angeles. I got fourth in the state meet in the three-quarter mile.
Not bad, fourth in the state.
Yeah. Then the senior in high school, I ran all the track meets as dual meets and invitational meets, and one of them was at Huntington Beach. I got second at Huntington Beach in a 50 school activity in the mile. I broke the school record, but it was not allowable because there were not enough watches on me. It have to be three watches if you're going to break a record. And the coach was the only one that had a watch on it. So I didn't get the record at that time.
Well, that's a bummer. What was your time?
I think 4:36.
Uh-huh.
Which wasn't bad that time in the 1940. We're talking 1940 now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty good run.
Folks on this program, they've heard Louis Zamperini, and of course his name is everywhere now with the release of the film Unbroken, which I understand you've already seen twice. You were a few years younger than him, but
yes.
Running in Southern California during that time period, were you aware of his exploits?
Oh, I was aware of Louis Zamperini, who came after Glenn Cunningham, Archie San Romani, Woodson, half a dozen others. The long-distance runners were the focus at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So records were going. So I remember Louis. He became a friend, maybe a little more than a casual friend, but I followed him in his high school career because when he was in running activities, long distance, I was coaching track and field there at Chula Vista High School.
Uh-huh.
So it was easy to follow him along and have him as a good example.
Sure. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just guessing if you were that good at distance running during that time period, did you have some dreams of maybe running in the Olympics someday?
Not the World Olympics, but while I was in the Army, as the war wound down, there was a Third Army Olympics. So I ran 5,000 meters in the Third Army Olympics in the Nuremberg Stadium. I got second place there. Another fellow from the 101st Airborne Division beat me about 20 yards.
Oh.
I couldn't make that one up. But interesting sideline is that as a tour that Brenda and I took, we ended up in Nuremberg on a miserably cold day. A tour guide told about the Nuremberg Stadium, and I said to him on the side that I ran here in 1945. So he put me on. And so I told a story of about 10 minutes there while all the people shivered while was running in the Nuremberg Stadium. That was a good recall for me.
Yeah. Well, and you've got a few of those, and there are so many stories I want to hear from you. But there's one question that I like to ask every veteran that I have the privilege of interviewing. It's about a specific date because everyone seems to remember it. December 7th, 1941. Where were you? How'd you find out that America was under attack?
I was on a basketball court early in the morning with four other fellas with a portable radio. And we heard it over the radio. That just stunned us. We stopped the game, went home, and picked it up at home from there on. Because this is a Navy community, and that was the buzz right away. This community is based on and founded on naval aviation.
Mm-hmm.
So it went around very fast here.
How big of a shock to the system was that? What did it mean to you?
Not as much as I thought it would, because we got so many things to do in front of us. Going to school, running track. We weren't eligible yet for any military duty. We were just to find out what the rest of the people were doing and who was going and when they were going.
Mm-hmm. When did it occur to you that you were going to be part of this war effort?
After 2 years of college.
Where'd you go to college?
At San Diego State Engineering Department. I ran on the freshman track team. We did some travel throughout the United States in our running activities. The three-quarter mile was part of our training, and I broke that record down to less than 3 minutes, while my record for the California State meet was 3:10. 2 years later, I was able to knock off at least 10 seconds to that record. But you don't post that record. It was just a workout kind of thing.
I think everyone's getting the idea you were in pretty good shape, but you didn't get to finish with the Aztecs because Uncle Sam was ready for you?
I was ready for him.
Uh-huh. So you made the decision.
Yeah, I made the decision. I volunteered for airborne activities.
When was that?
The second semester in my second year in college.
And how'd you hear about it? Were there some other paratroopers that came through with their flashy uniforms?
No, there was posters out at the San Diego post office. As you look at those, and you'd like to get into that kind of activity. You see, I was a risk taker.
You know, for someone who skydives every year on D-Day, I could see that you have that credibility as a risk taker.
Yeah, my father was stationed in the Panama Canal Zone in 1934. He was killed in an aircraft accident.
Oh, no.
So
you're just a teenager and you lost your father.
Yeah, I was 12 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, I was on my own father-wise from that point on.
Did you have siblings?
I had a sister.
Uh-huh.
She's up in Washington.
I would think when you hear your dad dies in an aircraft accident overseas that an airplane's the last place you want to go.
No.
What made you such a risk taker?
It was the focus of this community.
Uh-huh.
This community was based on aviation.
Sure.
So we were a good bunch of kids here. This was not a gangland area. We were a crowd rather than a gang.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of parties, a lot of dancing. A lot of school parties. North Island was our focus. Hotel Del was our focus. The girls dressed in formals. And we had so many formal dances, we couldn't recognize the girls in the same dress. They traded dresses. And we got them corsages every time.
Uh-huh.
You know? And if it wasn't at the Hotel Del, it was at North Island. If it wasn't at North Island, then it was probably an open house in Coronado somewhere. So we had a great time in this city.
Well, and you talk about the aviation focus of the community. Did you ever think that you were going to become a pilot, that's what your calling was?
No, I just saw the long span of types and kinds of activities. So I knew that this was boots on the ground. I knew that we were going to go into combat in some unusual manner and way, and that was part of the risk that I had learned to take since I was on my own.
And maybe some people don't realize it now, but this was really a new thing. The idea of a paratrooper, of someone who jumps out of an airplane behind enemy lines and fights his way to where he's supposed to be, that had never happened before World War II.
It was an experimental. The United States Army was trying to develop a million-man airborne army. The closest they got to it was the Corps,
mm-hmm.
which involved the 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, the British 6th, and a Polish regiment or a brigade, I'm not sure which there. That was the first Allied Airborne Army that operated in Market Garden.
And you already had a jump under your belt before that, but tell me about the training, because obviously, being a distance runner, you were in tremendous shape already, but something tells me there had to be some challenges throughout the time you spent training for the paratroopers.
Well, it was pathos there, and it was humor. The moment we got to our destination in Camp Tocoa, Georgia, they took us to a C-47 body with a 36-foot ladder, and you were required to climb that, go into that nacelle. You put on a parachute harness only. Just outside the open door on the other side of the aircraft where you entered was a 200-yard steel cable and a big pulley on it. So they connected you to the cable. You stood in the door, and the instructor gave you instruction. We were 36 feet in the air, and we had a 15-foot suspension. So you'd fall 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Telling us to look out, have the hands outside the door framework. Look out, don't look down. And that was the first test. By looking out, and if you did look down, you could see an inchworm, and that scared them out. That was the challenge right there. So I never looked down. I looked out. When they swatted me on the derriere, you were to take one step out into the open air, your arms folded across the reserve chest, your chin on your chest, and count to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And then to transfer a D-ring from your left hand to your right hand. If you drop that D-ring, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So we floated on down to the end of the cable detachment. We grouped there with about 5 to 10 people, and we went to the colonel. The colonel wants to know, what are you here for? And he expected an answer to kill Germans, you know. But nobody was that enthusiastic about that because we didn't know what we're getting into. If you pass the colonel and all his questions, he was looking for athletes and college kids.
Uh-huh.
He had no time to make silk purses out of sow's ears.
Mm-hmm.
He had to get the upper crust as best he could. So fortunately, I fit that pattern because I was in college, 2 years of college, engineering department, and I had a pretty good background in running. So leaving the colonel, we go to the psychiatrist. He asks you some silly questions. And then
silly questions like what?
Oh, I can't remember. They were so dumb. I think one of them was jump on your left foot. Or jump on your right foot or something like that. Use
really?
Both feet to jump. That,
uh-huh.
that kind of thought. And follow instructions with a colonel standing beside you. We're scared to death with the officers there, you know, because they barked and they didn't talk in soft terms.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go to the doctor and he gives you a physical exam again. So you pass all three of those. You go to W Company. And the next day you're assigned to a battalion in a regiment. And the regiment that was forming now was the 501 Parachute Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
The 506 Parachute Infantry preceded us at Camp Tocoa. After us, there were some artillery groups that came through. After that, I don't know what took place in Camp Tocoa, Georgia. But Camp Tocoa, Georgia was in the foothills where you smell anthracite coal burning in the night, a cold we didn't get used to, coming from Southern California, and it was 13 miles off Highway 13 and 13 miles from a cemetery. And those were awesome numbers at the time.
Yeah, it was. You were out there.
From Camp Tocoa, we went to Fort Benning, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and we had 4 weeks there. Our physical training was pretty tough. We'd be out there in the field, and we're doing all kinds of exercises. And the drill instructors were muscle-bound Apollos, and they wore T-shirts three times too small, so their muscles would stand out all over. So if we did something wrong in the ranks, the drill instructor would give us 25 push-ups.
Mm-hmm.
We annoyed them by telling them or asking them, which arm, sir?
Nice.
So we went through phase A, which was physical training, pretty fast because we were in good shape. Then B and C and D were more technical. D was 5 parachute jumps. And
were those from those famous jump towers from the World's Fair that they took down to Fort Benning?
Oh, yeah, you know about those towers.
I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah, they brought those in. And a couple of the exercises there where you lie down, you're on a parachute harness, then you raise you up 50 feet with the reserve on front of you with a D-ring. You pull the D-ring and it's exchange hands. If you drop that D-ring, they move you 50 feet higher.
I guess that helps you remember to not drop the D-ring.
If you don't do it right there, they move you up to 150 feet.
Wow.
If you don't do it there, I don't know if they move them to 200 feet or not. But I think maybe at 150 feet, you're doing things wrong. They brought you down again and gave you a good lecture. And maybe if they thought well of you, you might try it again.
Did any of that ever happen to you?
No, nothing happened. I was able to get through that one without any trouble. I mean, you do it with great tension and strength and focus, you know, because you're looking down on those guys. These towers had four arms, you remember. And one of the towers had a large basket-shaped parachute and a parachute put inside of it and a skirt attached to the exterior area of the ring of the design. And they would raise you up to 250 feet and then give you instructions, do this, and you would be floating free. But they were cautious about the direction of the wind because you could be blown into the tower itself. So they only used the arms were clear of the wind. So we had fun doing that.
You had fun doing that. It wasn't nerve-wracking? It wasn't scary?
No, we're getting kind of used to some of these things. We know we're being tested all the time, so we're under tension quite a bit. We're trying to outdo the guy next to us, too.
Sure.
No failure, you know.
Was it a pretty big deal when you qualified? When you made it through all that training?
Oh, yeah. The first one was nerve-wracking. I think I jumped number four. And you jump over the landing field there and right alongside of Chattahoochee River. The thing that we were concerned with, the Chattahoochee River, 1,200 feet, looks like it's part of the landing field. And there were incidents where some of the guys made preparation for a water landing when they were 50 feet in the air.
Ooh. How were your landings?
Hard.
Is there anything that prepares you for that, for what that feels like?
Well, we did parachute landing falls. We were attached to a harness on a cable, and we would slide down the cable, and the instructor would pull the trigger mechanism and release. We didn't know when we're going to be released. So we would drop down about 8 or 9 feet and then make a right shoulder arm, right shoulder a roll on it, and then come up standing at attention. So if you did something wrong there, you got 25.
I bet.
Then which arm, Sergeant?
Yeah, right or left.
Well, I'm sure with the kind of shape you're in, you could get 25 in while we're taking our first commercial break. 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California is our guest. When we come back from training to taking off late at night on June 5th, 1944, ready to jump behind enemy lines as part of the massive D-Day invasion. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, a screaming eagle from the 101st Airborne, 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California. A longtime high school track coach and U.S. history and government teacher, he lived through some pretty significant history, like parachuting behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. He's been giving us a real detailed look into the pioneering training of paratroopers during World War II. This was a new idea, a new approach, and so we can understand the historic context of it all. In preparation for all those intense moments overseas, there's a whole lot of crucial experience the Army tried to build into you here in the States before you left.
We had to go through a lot of practice maneuvers to build the coordination squad to squad, platoon to platoon, company to company, battalion, and then build it up to regiment and division. And all of that was done at the Tennessee maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were the Blue Army at one time and a Red Army at another time. There's a motion picture about that where some of the airborne guys were going to capture the commanding general of the Red Army. They did.
And that was important because, as you would find out the hard way later, it can get pretty chaotic when you're jumping behind enemy lines, especially in the darkness and especially when you don't get let go or dropped off where you're supposed to be.
I was selected for some Pathfinder experiments, so there's another challenge. So,
and explain to everyone, I've had some Pathfinders on the show, but explain to folks who don't know what you're talking about what a Pathfinder would be and the significance.
Pathfinders would be dropped on the drop zone, if I can use that term, where the majority of people were going to land, and they would set up a signal. They would use an instrument called Rebecca, and it set up a signal that was picked up by the lead plane of a group of 45 that had an instrument called Eureka. And that group of 45 aircraft would pick that signal up at about the distance of 20 miles, fly that signal, and on the ground where the Rebecca was being emitted, and that would be, according to in our division, it would be one of the letters of the Morse code. Our drop zones were A, B, C, D, almost in vertical alignment, except B was off the vertical alignment just a little bit, and it was underwater, and I can tell you a tough story about that one. I was picked to do some experimenting and to be dropped on the drop zone during the maneuvers. Mm-hmm. There was three of us. Most of the other two guys were in my squad. I was a squad leader for a long time and ultimately became a platoon leader. We dropped the night before on a Tennessee pine-covered area. Next to it was a watermelon patch. So I landed in a pine tree and bowed down, touched the ground. Nice. The other two guys were 50 yards from me. We got together, covered our parachutes up with pine needles, etc., and to sleep there that night. And then the next morning at 8 o'clock, the entire group of jumpers were going to come in. We were to set off orange canister signals on the drop zone. Mm-hmm. So that the pilot was sure he's coming in the right time, in the right place, the right moment, following a signal given by the Pathfinders, who were maybe 8 or 9 in number, operating the Rebecca process, and they laid a T, a luminous T, on the drop zone. Aircraft would fly up the long leg of the T, where the cross piece met the long leg. That is when the green light and the aircraft would go on, mm-hmm. and everybody goes out from that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we three were there that evening, hidden as best we could, all of our clothes and whatnot, and we slept there, and I heard a patrol come through, a Red Army patrol come through. So I alerted the other guy, two guys, and we were in our underwear. So we took off like rabbits. We went around in a big circle, and we found the watermelon patch. We came back where we were, hoping that the Red Army patrol was gone. They were. But we went back and picked up some watermelons from the and put them in the holes that we had dug, you know. And then the next morning when the guys came in, we distributed some watermelons to the guys in the squads.
You must have been popular.
Yeah. We got the orange signals off in time. I got those smoking the area. And a lieutenant colonel landed right next to me, and I didn't have my jacket on. He said, "Soldier, get that jacket on. The general will be here right now." So I did in a big hurry. That was my experience with the Pathfinders. It was never kept in the Pathfinders because I was a squad leader, and I had to go back to the squad for all the other activities.
But I imagine that experience, even though this was maneuvers and it's Americans against Americans, that experience of being a Pathfinder probably gave you an appreciation for what the Pathfinders in Europe went through and how dangerous that duty was.
Yeah, yeah. Because they are there by themselves with no support whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to set up quick and get those signals going because they're coming in by the thousands. Mm-hmm. There was 13,200 of us jumped in Normandy.
Right.
But anyway, we did with that experiment, and I didn't get in trouble with the watermelons, but I thought it was going to. And we maneuvered throughout the Tennessee area. We ended up in some hay fields one night. We had to bed down. We were told to bed down in the fields. We didn't have much to bed with except a blanket. So we pooled the blankets together And to cover ourselves, we raided the haystack. We took all the hay we could and made big piles of it and put that on top of us, and then the blankets underneath the hay. Some of the guys were very enterprising. They stole some of the farmer's chickens, and they cooked the chickens. And in order to bring this to the heavenly crescendo, they invited the Catholic chaplain to have chickens. He mm-hmm. refused, but he finally consented to have chickens. And the farmer stole my mortar sight. I couldn't find it the next morning. We found out a month later that a farmer had it because it showed up, and I had to pay a $36 fine to get that mortar sight back.
It's a heavy price back then.
Yeah. Then we went to Camp Mackel in North Carolina and had some fine-tuned training there. Then we given a 10-day furlough, came back to Coronado. Coronado was a dead city. All the men, for all practical purposes, men were gone. Hotel Del Coronado was live because that was a recreation center for officers. Mm-hmm. So I didn't spend all my time here. I went to Washington, D.C. and tried to hunt for my girlfriend. And I found her. She wasn't my girlfriend then. She was with a midshipman in a separate room. And a general and a couple admirals invited me to come to their table and have dinner with them because I was in uniform. And they asked me all kinds of questions here and there. That took care of the last couple of days of the furlough. Mm-hmm. Went back to Camp Mackel, and I did a 10-day activity and demolition training.
What did that consist of?
Making booby traps, working with dynamite, blasting caps, etc. We had to jump with 10 blasting caps, which is a pretty critical thing. They're fulminated things. You give them a real shock, and, you know, they go. Mm-hmm. We padded those things up in our pockets and our legs. Make sure you make a proper landing, and it'll go. You're not, if you're in the right pocket, you don't do your fall on the right side, for God's sakes. So,
otherwise, it's blasting Tom.
Yeah. So the sergeant instructor was showing us how a booby trap was made at a half-pound dynamite in the crotch of a tree with a tripwire, and he walked away from it, came back, and the half-pound dynamite began to slip. He reached up to grab it and cut the tripwire, and it exploded. It just tore up his right hand. So that was a bloody mess there. And said, oh, this is my first incident of real destruction. Mm. And it didn't stop from that point on.
I bet.
Well, we continued our training, and we went overseas to England on the William Gothel's ship. That was a 10-day trip. I got the mumps.
Uh-oh.
In the camp Miles Standish in Boston, both sides of the mumps. So they put me in isolation. I could hear the guys doing exercises on board. So by 10 days was over, I was ready to come out of that cocoon. So I took 10 guys to a hospital in Scotland while the rest of the regiment moved into Lambourne and got set up there. And then I went on south and met them a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
So then we trained and trained and trained, running through wheat fields, going over barbed wire fences, annoying the British. Everything we possibly could. We were having a lot of fun because we knew how to have fun. We were risk takers too. Mm-hmm. We're in a foreign country. We did things probably that were out of bounds, and we were 4,000 or more miles from home, and we knew nobody at home would ever hear about it.
Uh-huh.
You can fill that with all kinds of things that you want.
Well, are you going to share any examples with us, or are you going to leave it to our imagination?
Yeah, for instance, some of the guys would get in the tree on Lady Craven's estate, and she had a herd of deer. So the deer would mosey around, they would graze, they would do not. If they ever stood under a tree, one of the guys would jump out of the tree with a knife and kill a deer. That was not good diplomacy there.
No, not at all.
Those kinds of things, yeah.
But good venison, probably.
Yeah. And we found catacombs. And we maneuvered in and around and dug into the catacombs, which was dangerous. And clergymen didn't like that.
Sure.
So we were required to cover those up. I was sent to the British 6th Parachute Infantry Regiment while we're in England to make contact with them, because the keynote was, the colonel spoke of, you're going to have some relationships and the British 6th is going to be probably your friends. So get to know them. So two of us, we were both squad leaders, went to the British 6th, and we were oriented to their weapons. They were oriented to our activities, such as the rifle and the compass and all of that, all of those things, and what we looked like. We learned some demolition things there and how they were jumping. They were not jumping from aircraft. They were jumping from balloons. They couldn't afford to. put aircraft in the air.
Well, how about the buildup to Normandy? Were you starting to hear some rumblings that you guys were going to be sent across the channel?
No.
Nothing?
No.
It came out of the blue.
That was secret. We knew we're going to go to Europe, but that's all. We don't know where we're going to land. We know how we're going to get there, but where we're going to land, who's going to be with us, whether it's going to be British or going to be a Polish group or French or whatever it may be. We got radio communication from Axa Sally quite a few times, and she said, "We know you, the 501st Parachute Infantry, has just landed in England. We have 2,000 white crosses, not with your names on them, and you could use those crosses as stepping stones to get to the ground, and you won't need your parachutes because we're waiting for you."
Wow, that's encouraging.
Yeah, it was. So we gave her the raspberry, and she played good music after that, you know, all the Glenn Miller stuff. A few things happened like that. So
I know that June 6th is a very special day in your life, one of, I'm sure, a lot of mixed emotions, and we're going to talk later about what you do every year on that date, but probably the most accurate label attached to that day in 1944 is the longest day. And I imagine it started earlier for you than most.
Oh, yeah, about 4 to 5 hours earlier. I believe our takeoff time was 10:21 English double summer time.
On June 5th?
Yeah.
So late at night on June 5th. And where were you guys in England?
We were in an assembly area. The exact spot, I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. It was very close to Merrifield Airport. There were 11 airdromes in and about England where the paratroopers were gathering. Mm-hmm. And they would be taking off at different times, forming a wedge of 45 aircraft. Now, this mass armada is going to be 10 miles long. It's going to be at least 2 miles wide. The Pathfinders are going to take, I believe, 57 minutes to get to their drop zones. The paratroopers are coming in at 60-some minutes. And then the next morning, gliders in 76 minutes. I think it's just about a kind of a guesswork on that schedule. So we had trained hard. We were isolated. No contact with anybody on the outside. Some of the guys had English girlfriends. Could not make contact with them. No connection with the civilian population whatsoever. There was guards all around this assembly area. So we were given instructions continuously in there on what we're going to do. We had to go to some Nissen huts, and in the Nissen huts were tables, and built on the tables was a sand mock-up of the area we're going to land. I never did see those sand tables because I was assigned to the regimental assistant officer and had to know where he was, what he was doing, and be able to contact him immediately. You know, cleaned his weapons and whatnot. So I was kind of a gopher there. So I didn't get to see those tables. But our platoon officer was bigoted. And bigoted means he was given the secret information as to when we're going to take off and where we're going to land. And that's all he said. I'm bigoted. And he was not going to give us any information beyond that. So I was out of that context with that lieutenant colonel, knowing et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and be able to contact him immediately in case information came down. I left him on the evening of June 5 back to the company. We met early evening, and we went to our aircraft. We had 6 parapacks slung underneath the aircraft. Each one weighed 300 pounds and had all of our equipment, probably machine gun, tripod, and ammunition, and maybe a bundle full of K-rations or TNT or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. 6 parapacks underneath. Each one weighed 300 pounds. We rolled those, packed them, and rolled them, and attached them to the aircraft, and then practiced a drop so that things going to work.
Is that just a lever that releases them or something?
Yeah, number 2 man behind, I jumped number 1. Number 2 man had a switch. That would drop the 6 parapacks simultaneously. If that failed, number 3 man had a lever, and he would pull that lever, mechanical operation there. That would drop the 6 parapacks. So we had double check on that.
So you load onto this C-47?
The C-47 DC-3. Mm-hmm. And I jumped number one, last one to get in the plane. So I was number one seat there. It's the shape of an arrow. And we were parked on the side, what do we call part of that arrow. Each plane would swing down and then take off. If any plane had a problem, there would be a mess.
Yeah.
On one of the planes taking off, there was a fella in the plane who fired his rifle into his foot. Evidently, he freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
The officer went over and grabbed him, lifted him up, banged him up against the bulkhead of the aircraft. Just as it was moving down the runway, not going very fast, took him to the door and threw him out.
Wow.
This guy bounced a little bit, and then the medis picked him up. And then an inquiry occurred later after we came back from Normandy and completely exonerated the officer. That's what he should have done. We never knew who this fellow was. That was kept quiet.
Wow.
We know who the officer was.
Right.
That was
right.
Good. But anyway, here we are on the takeoff field. Planes were taking off, one right after another, one every 10 seconds. I mean, when that plane revved up, it sounded like every rivet was going to come apart. You know, I mean, there was noise. I went forward, sat down on the lower deck, and leaned against the cockpit door and told the pilot that if there's any problem that relates to us, let me know. I'll fall back and wake up. So I stayed in that position most of the time until the officer in charge, Lieutenant Jansen, told me to get up there to number one. You know, above the door, there's three lights.
Mm-hmm.
There's a red, a white, and a green one. The Pathfinders are already in. Some of them missed the drop zone. Some of them didn't. Some of them were spread so far apart that it's unbelievable. We got the worst drop in the entire 13,200.
Well, of course, we need to find out why you say that, but it's time for another break. Tom Rice of Coronado, California, our guest today. When we come back, we'll follow him out of that C-47 in the dark skies over France. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with D-Day paratrooper Tom Rice of Coronado, California. He's 93 years old, but he's planning to jump out of a plane again next June, just like he has the last few years, to honor those who died on the longest day. When we left off, he was waiting to lead 17 other jumpers out the door of their C-47 and out over the dark French landscape. And you described some of the chaos, and I have to ask, were you nervous? Were you scared?
I had too many jobs to do.
You were too busy to even think about it.
I was too busy.
Mm-hmm.
With the parapacks, with a number of guys. For instance, we took showers just before we took off.
Right.
Just before we took showers, we had dinner. Just before dinner, the colonel got us all grouped together, the entire regiment, and he stood on the hood of the Jeep and made a speech. Now, he had a Bowie knife, and he had a 4x8 foot piece of plywood. On one side was a picture of Tojo. On the other side was a picture of Hitler. And he practiced at 50 feet throwing that darn Bowie knife. You know, he had one time it bounced back and cut him.
Oh.
But anyway, here he is on top of the Jeep, and he's giving us a speech. The speech is recorded in a book that I wrote, word for word. He had his Bowie knife down on his ankle, and he reached down to get the Bowie knife, hold it over his head, and we're going to want every one of you to be able to put this knife in a German.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he reached down, and it wouldn't come out of his case. So he went to his French knife. So that incident became the laughing activity of the regimental unions after that. Colonel Johnson tried to get that Bowie knife out, and he couldn't do it. He made the best of it. So then he jumped down like a turkey vulture going to his first meal. He shook hands with every single one of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wished us Godspeed and whatever else.
Did that fire you up a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it relaxed us more.
Mm-hmm.
Because here you're coming in contact with a big man, you know. And
yeah.
In most cases, you're scared of this guy. When he comes around, you know, you bark. We were doing PE exercises one time, relay races. I was standing there ready to take the next guy on. The colonel jumped on my back. He said, "Let's go." So I had to run with him 220 yards with him on my back. And I didn't think I could make it. We got to the end of it. and he jumped off. He said, jump on. He carried me back to the beginning. Then he walked off, just left us there, and smiled at the company commander. I think he was checking on our physical condition.
I guess so.
So I was the instrument there. If I had looked bad, I'd have been real trouble. But anyway.
So getting back to your drop zone, you said out of 13,200 paratroopers, you got the worst drop zone.
Drop. We got the worst drop in the entire division, really.
Out of the whole D-Day operation.
On the whole D-Day operation, yeah.
Why? What happened? Where were you dropped?
When we took off at 10:41, English double summertime, we flew at 5,000 feet. We assembled in groups of 45 each. That was called a section. Mm-hmm. I was in section 14, third from the lead plane on the right. I'm jumping number one. We dropped down to 1,500 feet after the section had organized itself. Now, we were about 100 feet wingtip to wingtip.
Mm-hmm.
Real close, tight formation. We flew past Jersey and Guernsey Island. In the water was a small submarine that emitted a signal to show that we were on the right track for the pilots to follow. And then we got to another signal beyond Jersey and Guernsey Island, and that point we turned left. Now, if you can visualize the Cottonton Peninsula on the left and the Brittany Peninsula on the right, this was a neat scheme because the Germans didn't know whether we're going to go right or we're going to go left.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned left. I'm at the door getting things organized and following instructions. I looked out and I saw low tide. I saw the community of Brownsville, and I could see the pattern of rivers that ran into the channel there. White light is on. Red and green are off.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit Brownsville, the red light goes on, means we got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stand up and hook up. We're all standing up. We're holding on to the steel cable that runs, 3/8 inch steel cable that runs right through the center. Mm-hmm. We have to hook up our webbing to that. Mm-hmm. With an anchor line snap fastener in our left hand and make sure it faces the right way. Got it faced the wrong way, could be in trouble. So stand up and hook up. It was verbal signals and mechanical signals so that everybody understood. So I'm at number one, Van Buskirk and my squad, he's at number 18. And so we're all stood up, hooked up. Then count off for equipment check. Start with number 18. 18 checks number 17, but who checks 18? The jump master goes back and checks. Then he moves up to the front. So he says, 18 okay, 17 okay. We do that type of communication all the way to the number one. And I'm supposed to say, all okay. And are you ready? You know, all that stuff. Yeah, let's get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Right away. So at that time when a red light was on, we were checking, we ran into fog. Now, we're less than 100 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The lead plane had a blue light on the dome, and it was at a little lower altitude. The others were staggered up a little bit so the pilots could see the blue light. When that blue light goes on, that means that they got that lead plane got the signal from the Pathfinders, and they crossed the T, and they snapped on the green light. Everybody snaps their green lights on, so we jump at that point. Ran into fog. I was looking out the door, and I could see just almost a rectangular area that was just filled with tracers. There were yellow, there were red, there were green, and white. It looked like the 4th of July, you know. Nothing bursting like that, but tracers coming up.
You guys have been spotted, and the enemy's firing at you.
Yeah, well, we were heading into that.
Oh, this is ahead of you. You can tell that this
is what we're going to have to go through.
The artillery fire is already happening.
It's already happening. We're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. So they avoided it, and I think the pilot may have panicked a little here, because there was an investigation afterwards. We swung off to the right. All of Company C swung off to the right because we had 9 planes.
Mm-hmm.
Our company commander ended 20 miles from our drop zone. We didn't get together for a whole week. We were spread all over the place. We were originally, as I understood it, to jump on drop zone B. They found out that drop zone B was underwater. So it was fortunate that when they broke the pattern of flight, we were over the edge of D. And I went out over the edge of D. The only thing that bothered me is that I was going to get castrated because the machine gun bullets were on the left wing and they might come through the floor of the plane, you know. Mm.
So as you're jumping, your plane's getting hit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You could hear it on the wing.
Wow.
And now our gas tanks are not self-sealing. And the pilot is yawing and pitching. We're going up and down to avoid penetration with shells, you know, mm-hmm. and bullets, whatnot. Up and down. The guys were wobbling. The green light goes on. I jump, and just as I did, number one and number two men pull the switches. The plane goes up because the load was dropped.
Right.
And I went out the door at the same time. And when I turned, the prop blast, we were going 165 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We got a jump at 95 to 100. The jump master, lieutenant, called the pilot and said, slow this thing down, we can't jump. Now the pilot's yawing and pitching, whatnot. Mm-hmm. He ignored it. So when I went out, we were yawing and pitching, and the plane went up 50 feet. The parapets dropped. The prop blast hit me and threw me up against the side of the aircraft.
Wow.
My left arm got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. So I swung out. My helmet came down over my face. My reserve parachute was forced up to my face because the musette bag was underneath. So I didn't know what the dickens was going on. 2.8 seconds transpired, and that thing should have opened by that time. So I swung in and hit the aircraft side again, swung out, got the helmet up, and I saw the parapax cover of the parachute flapping under the rudder of the airplane. So number two and number three man got loose, got out. Mm-hmm. So when I swung back in, I turned a little bit, and I got free.
I can't imagine what that feels like. You talk about disaster here. This is your moment, your first experience in the war, really, in what's going to be a combat situation. You almost didn't get away from the plane.
Get away from it, yeah.
And you would have died.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't free yourself, probably.
I had a Hamilton wristwatch, a gold Hamilton wristwatch. It cost me $150, and that was stripped right off of my arm. My arm was black and blue from the armpit down to the wrist.
Ooh.
And I didn't know it until 3 weeks later and taking some clothes off. We didn't take any clothes off, you know. I have to guess at the altitude. I'll make a conservative guess. I jumped from 500 feet to 400 feet, 750.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the ground pronto.
That must have been a pretty rough landing.
Oh, yeah. It was a hard landing. So,
what'd you come down in? What kind of terrain?
It was a grassy area that was more pasture than anything, and then a small ditch that was, about 6 feet deep, full of water, smelly, dirty water. And so here I am on my back. I can't get my harness off because the musette bag, the reserve parachute, a May West, and a quick release. Now, the quick release had a toadstool type thing on it, and when you arm it, a red dot shows, and then you hit it like that and it springs out.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know about that thing,
right?
Okay, whatever they want to call it. I couldn't get at that thing. I had a double zipper up here under my chin with a switchblade knife, so I unzipped that, and incidentally I had the cricket under there. You know about the cricket?
Tell everybody about the cricket.
Yeah, okay, so just mention that so you're on track with me.
The cricket's going to come in handy later.
Yeah, maybe.
In theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
In theory, yeah.
Yeah.
So the cricket and the jump knife are in the same pocket, right? Double zippered right under my chin.
Uh-huh.
So I unzipped that. The cricket fell out. I lost it and didn't know it. I got the double-bladed knife out and start cutting the risers. I got halfway through one riser, and number two and three man came up. They had the mortar. Evidently, they had found one of the bundles and got the mortar. So that means time has gone by here for a little bit. So we crossed the canal, and Frank Ficarota, one of the guys in the carrying the mortar parts, went into the canal. We had to dig him out. He came out smelling like you can't believe, yelling and screaming. And this is supposed to be a quiet situation, you know.
So, yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's the middle of the night. Dark. You're supposed to be surprising the enemy.
So we got them quiet, and we worked our way over to a decomposed granite road. I heard some footsteps, maybe 150 yards away on decomposed granite. So I got them quiet, did the click. One of the guys did the click, mine was lost. and they got a click back.
And that's what, when you mentioned the cricket earlier, some people are saying, what, he's carrying little bugs around? No, this was a device that would allow you to communicate with others without drawing too much attention.
That's right, and no identification, you see.
What does it sound like?
Click, click, like that. Mm-hmm. You just didn't hold one click, you're going click, click.
Right.
And the answer would be double click, 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 click. Then we would work toward each other, clicking continually.
Right.
We got within safe distance. Then we'd use the password. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in the airborne and you're one of my friends, and we clicked successfully. I'm not sure about you. It could be a German enemy that has one of these things.
Yeah.
So I go with the password, flash.
Gordon.
You would then recognize that flash. Uh-huh. Possibly I'm an American.
Right.
I don't know still about you. You come back with thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Then that puts me at ease that you possibly are an American. Now, to cinch it from flash, thunder, then I'd say welcome. And a German trying to pronounce welcome, the W is a V, welcome, you see. You'd pick that up real quick. Mm-hmm. Then we'd meet, get up and hug each other and find out who we are. And he's probably somebody from the 82nd Airborne.
And you're doing all this, which you've never done before, not in this situation, in the dark, with an arm that almost got ripped off, a back that's probably all bruised up from
probably,
the impact.
Yeah.
Were you feeling pain? Were you even conscious of that?
No. I mean, our focus was to do what we're supposed to do and get organized and group.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got objectives.
And did you have any idea where you were?
No. Didn't even know I was on Drop Zone D. I made just the edge of Drop Zone D. Number 18 man, Marvin Van Buskirk, ended up in the English Channel. He was a pugilist and a strong swimmer. And the parachute opened up on him and started pulling him ashore a little bit. So he was aided in that to get ashore. And when he got ashore, he took all his clothes off and hid in a trench until he heard the shooting and got his wet clothes back on again and joined it.
Wow. So you were really close to the coast.
Yeah. It's about 6 miles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So we got these guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road, and we clicked them and met them, and we stood up and kind of conversed. And one of them came to me and said, "I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent."
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty. And if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, "I got a hand grenade with a pin pulled." I said, "Okay, give it to me." Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and they looked like I didn't recognize. Here's one of the things we tried to learn is the profile if we saw these guys at night and our maneuvers and their voice. I wasn't sure. There was a number of them, and I wasn't sure about their voices or their profiles, but I felt that things were friendly enough. I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even though I may not have been.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
But your leadership qualities,
there you go,
rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had to.
Yeah.
So,
sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, "Wait, if that guy, that's his problem, that's not your problem."
So we broke up into groups and went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, "Nothing's happening here, but I saw a house on the side of the road about 50 yards back," and said, "We got to investigate this." So I set about 5 of them around to the back of the house, and Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, "Don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know." He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be, you wouldn't believe this, in a long white nightgown from shoulder to floor, with a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. And the reason being, I suddenly recognized that's the Christmas Carol play, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
I saw that. And it looked like...
It looked like Scrooge.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. So he didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. Three or four of the guys followed behind me, and I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out from another door dressed the same way.
Uh-huh.
That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out and he got 6 rounds of ammunition. He gave us 4 and he kept 2. And so we left right away. Assured him we're not going to do anything because our objective was down the road. Well, mm-hmm. He ended up 2 kilometers. And incidentally, a guy gave me a trophy. And on the trophy is a paratrooper. And on the side of the trophy is St. Marie de Mont. And that was our objective.
And I have a picture of that trophy up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That was quite a coincidence, St. Marie de Mont. But as for achieving that objective, as for the fighting that took place at Normandy, what Tom would experience in Operation Market Garden in Holland, and how he was wounded at the Battle of the Bulge, you may have figured out by now we're going to have to save that until next time. What a memory he has. What a story he has. And don't miss the most intense moments next time on Hometown Heroes, when the things that this World War II paratrooper witnessed and endured will remind you again that freedom is not free.